niin en ole, niin silloin.
You're listening to Podmini.
You're listening to Podmini.
We all know the typical fairy tale love story. Two people meet, fall in love, and live happily ever after. But what happens when that happily ever after includes cannibalism, sleeping in a coffin, or killing your own parents? In True Love, True Crimes, we'll dive into those stories, examining the relationships of the world's most notorious criminal couples, their lives before they met each other, their love story, their crimes, and how their grisly fairy tale ended. You'll hear all about people who truly would do anything for love. A husband and wife who killed people they thought were witches. A woman who fell in love with a con artist and kept his con going to find victims. A couple whose idea of a dinner date was cooking each other a rack of human ribs. All of the important questions will be answered, like how they met, who kissed who first, who found the first victim, and who testified against their lover in exchange for a shorter prison sentence.
You've been listening to a Podmini original production. Thank you.
Podmini.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.
While spending a lot of time at home more often recently, I found myself a brand new hobby: jigsaw puzzles. I'm lucky enough that Unidragon have sponsored this episode of Morbidology. They create and sell premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles, and offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. What I love about Unidragon jigsaw puzzles is how beautiful they are. They're perfect for people who love nature and animals, with names like the majestic wolf, the alluring unicorn, and the charming owl. Jigsaw puzzles are a great way to pass the time. It's a fun, low-stakes activity which can help reduce anxiety and even increase your memory and problem-solving skills. Also, it's super satisfying when you finally complete one, and they're fun to collect as well. So head on over to unidragon.com and click the link in my show notes and use the code DRAGONBEFORE for 10% off. That's DRAGONBEFORE for 10% off. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. North Shore is a picturesque area on the coast of Sydney, in Australia. It is dotted with intimate villages and is a world away from the hustle and bustle of city life in Sydney. In 2013, a well-known and well-liked man from North Shore was the victim of a vicious attack. In trying to uncover what had happened to him, a media frenzy focused on his private life, posting lurid story after lurid story about the most intimate aspects of his life, for the whole world to see. Morgan Huxley was a 31-year-old man living in Neutral Bay, in Sydney's North Shore. He owned and operated Huxley Marine on Sydney Harbour, and was an integral part of a close-knit group of friends. His friend, Carla Pavinich, said that he was down to earth, funny, and charming. His mother, Dee Huxley, was a well-known, award-winning children's book illustrator, and when Morgan was a little boy, she dedicated a story to him titled Morgan and the Tooth Fairies. Morgan was a passionate man who loved animals and cared deeply about environmental issues. He adopted a lion in Africa and had a dog called Senna. He loved boats and once purchased a prawn trawler, which he could put love into and restore into its former glory. He was also known as a bit of a party animal and was quite often the last to leave a party. He was the middle child of Alan and Dee Huxley. He had an older sister, Tiffany, and a younger brother, Oliver. He had lived with his parents in Balmain before moving to North Shore. In early 2013, he set up his own pontoon building business after he had worked as a contractor for similar businesses in the area. It was the 8th of September 2013 when Morgan went to the Oaks Hotel in Neutral Bay to have a beer at the bar on his own. Morgan's apartment was near the hotel and he was a regular since it was just a 5-minute walk from his apartment. One of the bar attendants joked that they saw Morgan more often than they saw their own family. He was well known and well liked by the bar staff, and he sat at the bar and watched the highlights from the federal election just the day beforehand. This night, however, Morgan appeared to be quite peculiar. Despite the fact that it was 1 a.m, he was wearing a pair of sunglasses and was barefoot. He had just spent the afternoon at a friend's engagement party and had gotten a taxi home sometime after midnight. Within an hour, he left his apartment and went to the Oaks Hotel. That night, at around 3 a.m, Morgan's roommate, Jean Redmond, woke up to the sound of gargling noises emanating from Morgan's bedroom. She walked down the hall and opened up the bedroom door. She was horrified to discover Morgan bleeding heavily from a number of stab wounds on his bedroom floor. She called the 000 number and paramedics and police arrived at the scene. When they arrived, Morgan was already in cardiac arrest. Time truly was of the essence, and 4 paramedics jumped into the ambulance with Morgan and worked on saving him as they rushed towards the Royal North Shore Hospital. Despite exhaustive attempts to save Morgan's life, he was pronounced dead a short time later. He had been slashed and stabbed 28 times on his upper body in a wild and frenzied attack. He was nude from the waist down and the attack had unfolded in his bedroom. He had sustained 3 significant stab wounds to the same side of his neck, as well as dozens of smaller and shallow stab wounds to his back. Homicide detectives set up Strike Force Bandit to investigate the murder. The first point of action was to retrace Morgan's steps. It was known that he was out the night before at the hotel, but it wasn't yet known what time he had left and whether he had left alone or with somebody. Investigators asked businesses along Military Road to hand over their CCTV footage for review between the hours of 12:15 a.m. and 3 a.m. Surveillance footage would capture Morgan leaving the hotel alone at 1:30 a.m. after drinking 1 beer and then crossing Military Road towards his home, which was just around 150 meters away. Investigators searched the bins of nearby residents and interviewed a number of business owners in a bid to find the murder weapon, but to no avail. An outpouring of grief from Morgan's loved ones followed the grim news of his murder. Messages of confusion and condolences flooded Morgan's Facebook page. Jeff Joseph wrote, "Such a beautiful person. Everyone loved you, bro. You're a league of your own. You have left this place way too early and in the prime of your life." Another friend, Hannah Watt, wrote, "You will never be forgotten. Your lovely smile and charm will sadly be missed. I have never met a man as lovely and sweet as you, Morgan." Morgan's roommate, Jean, who had found his body, didn't return to the apartment after the murder. She moved in with her boyfriend and had been unable to return to work after being traumatized by what she had seen. The murder stunned not only Morgan's friends and family, but the entire community. Many people were left wondering how a hard-working young man, with seemingly no enemies, could end up being viciously stabbed to death in an upmarket North Shore suburb where crime is low. Associate Professor of Criminology at Queensland Bond University, Dr. Wayne Petherick, said that the three neck injuries were very deliberate and very angry, adding that he speculated that based on those three injuries, Morgan was either lying down or sitting down when he was lunged at by his killer. He said, three in the same location on the body is a very fast attack. He's been stabbed a third time before he's even registered. What's happening? Days after the stabbing, it was announced that investigators speculated that a scorned lover was the most likely suspect in the brutal slaying. A senior police source said to the Daily Telegraph, he was very popular with the ladies. We are examining his romantic interests. While CCTV footage had captured Morgan leaving the bar alone, they were considering that he potentially bumped into a lady friend, somewhere between the hotel and his apartment, and brought her home, or that his killer was lying in wait near his apartment on Watson Street. The senior police source added, his relationships with women are a strong line of inquiry. While investigators were working on the theory that the suspect was a scorned lover, Morgan's friends said that Morgan wasn't the type of man to make enemies. They said that Morgan was an approachable and friendly man who didn't upset people. They said that they would be hard-pressed to find somebody who didn't like Morgan. Rebecca Prinz, who had dated Morgan in the lead-up to his murder, said that she had no idea who could have harmed Morgan, adding that the time she had spent with Morgan was the best time of her life. She also said that she was now living in fear of Morgan's murderer. Rebecca wasn't the only woman to come forward to say that she had been dating Morgan in the months leading up to his murder. She was one of four who came forward. Investigators had a tricky job of untangling a web of relationships and were closely scrutinizing every aspect of Morgan's life. The senior detective working on the case stated, "We don't have any suspects at this time. We are just going through his friends and having them account for their movements on the night." Investigators were trying to figure out what happened between the time Morgan was dropped home by a taxi after the engagement party and when he went to the Oaks Hotel. The investigation would reveal that there was no sign of a break-in to the apartment, which further compounded the theory that Morgan had been murdered by somebody that he knew. On the 17th of September, hundreds of mourners gathered to pay their final respects to Morgan at his funeral at the Macquarie Park Crematorium Chapel at North Ryde. The song The Scientist by Coldplay emanated through the chapel as Morgan's yellow and green coffin was carried in. At the service, his family vowed to get justice. His brother Oliver said, "You were taken from us in a way which can only be described as horrific," before describing his brother's killing as cowardly and heinous. Morgan was remembered as a sports-loving man with a cheeky smile, who taught his friends to slow down and love the world. Jessica Hall, a former girlfriend, said that she fell in love with Morgan in year 6 at Lane Cove Public School because he was a fast runner and liked her handwriting. She fondly recalled how they spent the majority of their 20s together, and that some of her happiest times were when she was with Morgan. Funeral celebrant David Reardon said to the congregation, "Nothing about your loss seems right. Nothing." He urged them to try and celebrate Morgan's life, even though he had been taken so cruelly, in such a barbaric fashion. His sister Tiffany recollected Morgan's funny dances and said that no matter where he was now, she was sure that he would be dancing up a storm and making plenty of noise. She said, "It will never be the same without you, but I will see you in a sunny day, in a raindrop, in a spider's web." Morgan's parents, Alan and Dee, were understandably too emotional to speak during the service, but in a note, his father said, "You don't know how happy you used to make us. In my heart, my beautiful boy, you'll never walk alone." Investigators working the homicide were in attendance at the funeral. They were under the presumption that Morgan's killer could have been in attendance. Three unmarked cars were parked outside with one positioned among graves, so that investigators would have the best vantage point. By this point in the investigation, the crime scene had been fully examined, and forensic scientists were looking at fingerprints and DNA samples found inside Morgan's bedroom. Speaking to the Sydney Morning Herald, a senior detective stated, We don't have any suspects. We are working through all of the people in his life. Associates, just people from his life, and going through them methodically and getting statements from them. They said that they still didn't have a suspect in the murder, but said that they didn't believe that June, Morgan's roommate, was involved. Early next week, investigators announced that they were investigating up to 14 women who may have been romantically linked to Morgan. They were still working on the theory that Morgan had been targeted by a scorned lover. Investigators were trawling through Morgan's phone records as well as his internet activity to try and identify people that he had been in contact with in the run-up to his murder. Meanwhile, around 30 investigators combed the expansive area from Watson Street, where Morgan was killed, and the grounds of Anderson Park. They were armed with garden hose, torches, and evidence bags as they tirelessly searched for clues, in particular, the murder weapon. They looked in bins, drains, underneath parked cars, and in bushes and garden beds. With the investigation still underway, it was announced that it was speculated that Morgan may have been attacked while he was having sex. In what they described as a potential booty call gone wrong, investigators revealed that they had determined that Morgan had taken part in sexual activity shortly before he was stabbed to death. They announced that a forensic examination of Morgan's bedroom uncovered evidence of sexual activity, and they were now waiting for the results of blood tests and a toxicology report. They said they believed that the adrenaline levels could indicate the likelihood that Morgan had been sexually aroused before his murder. A police source stated, "It could be that he took the wrong girl home. We don't know." It would then be revealed that several DNA samples had been found inside Morgan's bedroom, and investigators were asking persons of interest to voluntarily provide a DNA sample, including the 14 women who had recently been linked to Morgan. Investigators further revealed that they had narrowed their focus down to several persons of interest. They refused to elaborate and only said that they were progressing in the hunt for Morgan's killer. The following day, investigators once again turned their attention to CCTV footage. They made their way to the shops in Neutral Bay, which was only a few blocks away from Morgan's home, and asked shop owners to hand over the CCTV footage from the entire night. They were working on the assumption that Morgan's killer had fled towards the Neutral Bay shops after leaving Morgan bleeding to death. Then in early October, there was a shocking update in the case when it was announced that a 20-year-old man had been arrested in connection with Morgan's murder, and charges were expected to be filed. The man was identified as Daniel Jack Kelsaw, who lived just streets away from Morgan. Investigators were alleging that Daniel had followed Morgan home from the Oaks Hotel before attempting to strike up a conversation in the hopes that he could go back to his apartment and have sex with him. They speculated that Morgan let Daniel into his apartment because there were no signs of a forced entry. They further stated that they had believed that Daniel had murdered Morgan at some point between 2:55 a.m. and 3:10 a.m., shortly before he was found by his roommate. The following day, Daniel appeared in court where he was charged with murder and larceny after he allegedly stole money from Morgan before fleeing his home. His defense lawyer, George Breton, announced that his client was assisting investigators and was unsure if he was going to fight the charges. He stated, "It's a matter for later instructions and later conversations. At the moment, all I can tell you is we will be back here next week." Outside of court, New South Wales Police Acting Squad Commander Angelo Mamolo said that there was no evidence to suggest that Daniel and Morgan knew one another. He said that they had met at some point after Morgan left the Oaks Hotel that night and returned home. He revealed that CCTV footage had captured Daniel following Morgan as he left the Oaks Hotel and as he walked home. More CCTV footage had captured them walking across a road together. It would further be revealed that in addition to the CCTV evidence, they had found Morgan's blood on a satchel owned by Daniel, as well as on a pair of his prescription glasses. Morgan and Daniel had been leading parallel lives in the months leading up to Morgan's murder. Following Daniel's arrest, a number of locals said that they were adamant that they'd seen Morgan and Daniel in the same shop or restaurant. However, they all said that it appeared as though they were not together and didn't actually know one another. While the investigation was still quite in the early stages, this led to many wondering if Daniel had stalked Morgan. After Daniel was arrested and charged with Morgan's murder, his parents said that they were completely shocked and were thinking of Morgan's family. Locals and the media alike were scrambling to try and uncover who Daniel was, because by all initial appearances, he seemed to be quite an enigma. Daniel lived at home with his parents and a younger sister. He was openly gay and was a solitary figure who much preferred to be at home or walking the streets alone. In late 2010, Daniel started being treated for depression and was taking Seroquel, an antipsychotic drug. He had been adopted by Mark and Lynn Kelsall as a young boy and had grown up in a leafy upmarket suburb and had everything a child could ever want. Even as a young boy, people said that Daniel didn't fit in. One classmate said, "Daniel seemed to get anxious very quickly and lash out. He was quiet, but he had quite a penetrating stare." When Daniel was arrested, he was clutching a fantasist novel called The Magician, which tells the story of an orphan who is the apprentice to a master magician. To those living in the area, Daniel had claimed that he was an apprentice of sorts, and had told others that he worked as a chef's assistant. According to his Facebook, he worked at Sydney Cooking School, but when they were approached, they denied that he had ever worked there. The owner said, "We can't find any record of him. He's a ghost." Coincidentally, Sydney's cooking school owned the chef and the barista, where Morgan was a regular customer. Do you grind your teeth in your sleep? If so, you're one of the 40 million Americans who do. There are a number of causes, such as stress, anxiety, or even an abnormal bite. Grinding your teeth can sadly cause a number of problems, such as worn enamel, tooth decay, sleeplessness, and expensive dental problems. According to dentists, the number one teeth grinding prevention is a custom-fitted night guard. However, these can be very costly, with the average dentist charging around $200 to $300 per night guard, and you can grind through several of those a year. That's where today's sponsor, Smile Brilliant, comes in. Smile Brilliant uses a lab direct process to bring you the same custom fitted night guard, but for as little as $45 per night guard. In addition, they also have custom fitted whitening trays and the Carry Pro electronic toothbrush. For me personally, taking care of my teeth is of utmost importance, and Smile Brilliant make it straightforward and affordable. Just head on over to smilebrilliant.com and use the promo code Morbidology. Check out for 30% off. Once again, that's smilebrilliant.com and use code Morbidology for 30% off your order. If you're like me, sometimes you need a break when listening to true crime. Well, what could be better than a mobile puzzle game filled with cute characters? I'm sure you've already heard of Best Fiends. There's over 100 million global downloads. It truly seems like everybody is playing it, and I think that you should too. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. As you make your way through the levels, you collect cute little monsters that you can evolve. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I'm out walking my dog. I'm already on level 261. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Investigators working on the case would soon reveal that Daniel was not initially a suspect in the murder. However, investigators had turned their attention to him after he voluntarily called police to inform them that he had sex with Morgan on the night that he was murdered. He claimed that they had met up and walked back to his apartment together that night, where he was invited inside. He said that they had consensual sex, and that he left the apartment sometime before 3 a.m. He additionally said that when he was leaving Morgan's apartment, a young woman went into the apartment, but he wasn't sure what happened next. Investigators immediately flagged Daniel's version of events as false and began looking into him as a suspect. While the owner of Sydney Cooking School claimed that Daniel didn't work there, it would later be uncovered that he did, but the owner had been advised not to speak about the case in the media. In fact, Daniel had been working on the night that Morgan was murdered and finished his shift at 1 a.m. The following afternoon, Daniel was back at work, where he informed his boss, Brett Deverell, that he was shocked by the murder and was afraid to walk home. Speaking with Fairfax Media, Brett said, "Absolutely normal as anything. You would not have known a thing. He acted as surprised as everyone else." He said that Daniel didn't work as a chef, but instead worked as an after-hours contract cleaner. He informed Fairfax Media that Daniel suffered from Asperger's syndrome, which is why he wanted to work behind the scenes, as opposed to out the front of house. He stated, "He was obsessed with being a chef's apprentice and always turned up wearing chef's pants. He didn't need to. He could have done it in his trackies. We found him very docile and slow and quiet. Could hardly get a word out of him." Further investigation into the moments leading up to Morgan and Daniel crossing paths would reveal that Daniel had been lurking around Grosvenor Lane, which was located just across the road from the Oaks Hotel bar. From Grosvenor Lane, Daniel would have had a direct view into the bar. With the case making its way through the justice system, a memorial plaque was arranged for Morgan overlooking Sydney's harbour. His family arranged to have the plaque and native tree planted at White Horse Point in Elkington Park. They said that it was a way to celebrate Morgan for who he truly was, a man who loved the great outdoors, cared deeply for animals, and who had an infectious sense of humour. His mother Dee stated, "Everyone loved him, young and old, and he was able to talk to anyone about anything." The following year, it would be revealed that Daniel had been charged with possessing child abuse material. Court documents alleged that investigators had found a child abuse material on Daniel's personal computer and a hard disk storage device when it was searched. All of the matters against Daniel were adjourned until the 15th of May. During the court hearing, Daniel was further charged with indecent assault and aggravated break-in with intent to commit a serious offence, as it was revealed that Daniel had broken into Morgan's apartment that night at 2:55 a.m. sexually assaulted him, and then killed him. This revelation was a stark difference to what the initial theory was, that Morgan was targeted by a scorned lover who he invited home for a booty call, or that he had allowed Daniel into his apartment. In June, it was announced that Daniel had been committed to stand trial. 2 months later, Daniel appeared in court where he pleaded not guilty to the murder. During the hearing, Daniel's lawyer, George Breton, told the Supreme Court that a high-profile barrister had been set to represent his client, but that he couldn't continue. He said that Daniel was now applying for legal aid representation for the trial. The murder trial began in March of 2015. During opening statements, Crown Prosecutor Peter McGrath, SC, took the jury through the facts of the case. He detailed how Morgan had gone to the Oaks Hotel bar alone and drank a beer, as Daniel stood across the road, looking in. When Morgan left, CCTV captured Daniel walking in the same direction after him. He stated, "He breaks into a very quick walk a couple of times, almost a jog, as though perhaps trying to catch up with Morgan Huxley." He said that at some point between 1:30 a.m. and 2 a.m, Jean had awoken to the sound of something knocking on the front door, but fell back asleep. Then at some point around 3 a.m, Jean woke up once again to the sound of a thud and then gargling noises. Deciding to investigate, she entered Morgan's bedroom. Prosecutor McGrath stated, he was lying on his right side at the door. He had blood all over his face and blood all around the top of his body. Prosecutor McGrath went on to reveal that before Morgan's murder, Daniel had confided some deep and disturbing fantasies to a psychiatrist. In 2012, Daniel had told his psychiatrist, Dr. Matthew Bolton, that he had intrusive thoughts and a thrill to kill. He told the psychiatrist it would probably be totally random with a knife, before telling him that he could hide a body. In fact, he had even told the psychiatrist that he had taken a knife from the cooking school where he worked and walked home intending to kill somebody, but didn't come across anybody. Prosecutor McGrath said that the fantasy echoed what happened to Morgan. Prosecutor McGrath told the jury that Daniel's right ring fingerprint was found on Morgan's door, and his DNA profile was found on Morgan's genitals. During the defense's opening statements, Barrister Christopher Watson said that Daniel would be giving evidence to explain the damning aspects of the Crown's case against him. He went on to say that no blood was found on the clothing or shoes that Daniel was wearing that night, and said the blood found on Daniel's satchel could have transferred if his client was near Morgan when harm first came to him. The first witness to testify during the trial was Jean. She told the jury that she had woken up at around 1:30 a.m. to what she thought was Morgan returning home. She said that she went back to sleep but was woken up once again by what she described as a screeching sound, which sounded like chalk on a blackboard coming from Morgan's bedroom, adding that she also heard what she believed was a snoring or gargling noise. When the strange noise continued for 5 minutes, Jean decided to get up and check on Morgan to make sure that he was okay. She said that Morgan often left the front door of the apartment unlocked so that people could visit. Jean had called her boyfriend, Ertan Usar, who arrived at the apartment shortly before police and paramedics. When he arrived, he found that the bolt lock on the door was locked. Both he and Jean said that this was out of the ordinary because Morgan liked to keep the door unlocked. Ertan was called to the witness stand where he described entering the bedroom and seeing Morgan on the floor, with his shorts pulled down and his t-shirt pulled up. Under cross-examination, he said that in the time leading up to Morgan's murder, he had seen a lot of different women with Morgan at the apartment. Testimony from paramedic Mark Lenigan would follow. He told the jury that when he arrived on scene, Morgan's blood had already clotted, indicating that he had been bleeding for quite some time. He said that his t-shirt and shorts were soaked in blood and that he was not breathing and had no pulse. Another paramedic, David Rigby, who arrived on the scene shortly thereafter, said that Morgan's body was warm to the touch, indicating that blood had been circulating throughout his body quite recently. He described Jean as being absolutely terrified and traumatized by what had happened. His testimony was followed by Senior Detective Sergeant Mark Jukes, who told the jury about the first time he interviewed Daniel. He said that he told Daniel that he had been captured on CCTV following Morgan on the night of his murder. Daniel denied that he was following Morgan, stating, "I wasn't following him, I just left work at the same time." He said that he had spotted Morgan using the ATM.
What I'm doing is conducting an electronically recorded interview between myself and Daniel Jack Kelsall. Time according to me is 6:41 p.m. on Tuesday the 24th day of September 2013. I am Detective Senior Sergeant Mark Jukes from the Homicide Squad. Of this interview, can you just state your full name, date of birth, please?
Daniel Jack Kelsall. Born on the 5th of February 1993, I walked into the convenience store where the person who I thought was fearless guy was trying to get money out of the machine. Very funny. I then had a small conversation. He, the fearless guy, Morgan,
Morgan. Yes, Morgan, yes.
Morgan asked me if I wanted to use the money at the ATM.
He asked me.
I replied no and then left.
Daniel was asked whether he owned any knives. He said that he had a black bag in his bedroom with two large knives in it, and also a small samurai sword. Next, an interrogation video of Daniel was played out. It had taken place 2 weeks after the murder, and Daniel told the investigators that he had never met Morgan, and was horrified to learn of his murder. While he had claimed that he'd never met Morgan, he said that he had seen Morgan earlier in the night, and laughed because he noticed that he was wearing no shoes.
You called him No Shoes?
No, not to his face. No, that's what you said. The name that I had for the person No Shoes.
No Shoes. Have you ever seen him before?
No.
Never?
Not to my knowledge.
Sorry?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, it's possible that I may have walked across paths.
But you don't know him?
No.
When questioned about whether he had interacted with Morgan, he said that he smiled at him when he turned his head, but that was it. He was presented with footage which clearly showed him running after Morgan. When asked why he was running, Daniel said that it was cold.
I'm just going to show the camera there what we're going to show you there, which is camera 7 on their security system.
Do you know who that is?
It's me.
So that's the same bag you've got?
Yeah.
And you said you own a number of those shirts.
Yeah, and a number of pants.
Do you recall, does this assist us in determining what shoes you were wearing that particular night? Why'd you jog?
It's cold. Mum always tells me if you're cold, go for a jog.
How far did you jog for?
Not very far.
How far is not very far?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. From the lights, a little bit after the lights, to a little bit before the opening to the restaurant, the restaurant.
The investigator asked Daniel why, if he was cold, did he not take a more direct route home?
Where you were, over here on Bimboyd Road, and then you've indicated you've sort of walked back up Military Road, across Watson. If you're cold, I'm just wondering why you would go that way. That doesn't look like the most direct route.
I don't know. I don't, when I get tired, I don't really pay attention to a lot of things. I think it was because I wanted to check in at work.
Daniel replied, "I get distracted. I may be cold, but I'm still interested in stuff." Daniel's mother, Lynn Kelsall, would testify in defense of her son. In a statement which was read aloud in court, she described her son in glowing terms. She said, "Daniel Jack Kelsall is a caring and nice young adult. He enjoys his job and spends a fair amount of time at home." His father, Mark Kelsall, then told the jury that his son had become withdrawn and morose when taking a heavy dose of medication after being misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. He said that after the murder, his son appeared to be afraid and asked him for a lift to work. He told the jury, "He told my wife he hadn't done anything, but I haven't asked Daniel. I'm emotionally involved. I understand Daniel as a person. I think he's a great person, a good person, and I couldn't see him being involved. It's just not in his nature." Daniel's boss, Brett Deverell, described him as a timid bookworm and geek, who often got teased because of his red curly hair and his sexuality. He said that he would always be seen with a book in his hand, and said that he had never once seen him lose his temper. Next up was Christopher Maroney, a friend of Morgan. He told the jury that Morgan had told him that he and a former girlfriend could not have a conversation without it ending up in a yelling match. During examination by defence Watson, he admitted that Morgan had called this ex-girlfriend a psycho and said that she had tried to blackmail him on one occasion. He further admitted that Morgan had recently had a problem with two women, after one found out that the other had been taken out by Morgan. It was evident, by their line of questioning, that the defence was trying to present a theory that Morgan had been killed by a scorned lover. Christopher was also asked about a man named John, who Morgan had rented his business premise from. Christopher said that in August of 2013, Morgan had told him that he had a run-in with John. He said that they had argued about money and John had told Morgan to fuck off. This dispute led to Morgan moving out of John's jetty. This was something that three romantic partners of Morgan had confirmed. Allegedly, John had told Morgan that he would square up to him if it was the last thing he did. This John was identified as John Giddens, and he was called to the witness stand, where he denied that he had ever said that. One of the girlfriends, Jessica Hall, said that she never got the impression that Morgan was actually scared of John or ever feared for his life. DNA evidence would also be presented during trial. Detective Sergeant Gregory Moon said that a satchel belonging to Daniel had evidence of Morgan's blood on it. He said that the blood was transferred through someone wearing the bag at the same time as the stabbing, or laying on the bed in close proximity to Morgan being stabbed. He said that there was evidence that somebody had attempted to clean up the blood. Prosecutor McGrath asked the detective how likely it was that the blood was transferred by someone found not to be in close proximity to the stabbing, and he said that he couldn't rule that out, but said he didn't think there would be a high probability of that occurring. As mentioned during opening statements, in addition to the blood, Daniel's fingerprint was found on Morgan's door, and Daniel's DNA was found on Morgan's genitals. Podcorn are revolutionising podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. I'm lucky enough that Podcorn have sponsored this episode of Morbidology. There was once a time when only the big popular podcasts received sponsorships, but with Podcorn, indie podcasts such as Morbidology are able to work with amazing brands. Podcorn truly takes the confusion and stress out of finding sponsorships for your podcast, or even for finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect and either earn money for their podcast or advertise their brand. All you need to do is sign up to Podcorn for free and begin browsing the marketplace. The marketplace is easy to use and even has a handy calendar. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. You can charge whatever you want so you aren't constrained by the industry standard. Podcorn is an amazing way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes and sign up to Podcorn today. In addition to Dr. Bolton, Daniel had also confided in Dr. Susan Allman about his intrusive thoughts about killing somebody, telling her that he hadn't thought about the consequences of what would happen if he did kill someone. Following their conversation, Dr. Allman wrote, "He had been having some intrusive thoughts about killing people on the way home at night. He had taken a knife home with him one night but didn't meet anybody." When Dr. Bolton testified, he said that when he spoke to Daniel, he got the impression that he was psychopathic. When Defence Watson asked Dr. Bolton if he would have contacted authorities if he felt as though Daniel posed a risk to anybody, he said that he would have contacted authorities if he believed that somebody was in imminent danger. After the doctor's testimony, the defence called Daniel to testify. On the witness stand, Daniel made the startling claim that he and Morgan were having consensual sex that night when an unknown attacker came into Morgan's apartment and attacked him. He said that they had struck up a conversation as they crossed Military Road at the same time. According to Daniel, as they chatted, Morgan invited him back to his apartment to continue talking. Daniel claimed that he asked Morgan how he relieves his stress, and Morgan told him that he had some friends who he would get intimate with. Daniel claimed that he asked Morgan, "Did you get with any tonight?" To which Morgan replied, "No, because they were all busy." Daniel told the jury, "I said, do you want to do things with me?" He seemed very hesitant at first. He checked his phone and sort of said yes. Daniel said that Morgan suggested they could go into his bedroom if they were quiet. When in the bedroom, Daniel claimed that as soon as Morgan entered the bedroom, he dropped his pants. He said that he fondled Morgan for around 10 minutes, until he felt something hit him hard on the head, and then noticed that somebody else was in the bedroom. He stated, "It looked like this other person and Mr. Huxley were fighting. I then got out of there. I stood up and ran out." He said that he could not describe the person and wasn't even sure what gender they were. This version of events was completely different to what Daniel had said in his interview with investigators, that he hadn't followed Morgan and that he had never met him. In fact, this was the third version of events coming from Daniel. During a second interview, Daniel had told investigators he saw a woman entering Morgan's apartment after he left. He admitted that he had cleaned the blood from his satchel, stating that he wanted to disassociate himself with what had happened. Daniel was the last witness called to testify. Following his testimony, Justice Robert Allen Hulme urged the jury to carefully consider all of the evidence that was presented to them before sending them off to begin their deliberations. There was no question that whoever had attacked Morgan had done so with the intent to kill. But the question was, who had killed him? Would the jury believe Daniel's version of events, or would they dismiss them as fabrication? In less than 3 hours, the jury reached a verdict and found Daniel Kelsall guilty of the murder of Morgan Huxley. During the sentencing phase, Prosecutor McGrath asked for a life sentence, stating that psychiatrists had found no evidence that Daniel was suffering from a mental disorder that explained his crime, but said that he had a personality disorder with psychopathic traits. Morgan's family were allowed to provide impact statements. His sister Tiffany said, "I don't feel joy in my life anymore. I don't know when I will again. Morgan's murder has snuffed out so much light in my life that I sometimes wonder what the point is." His brother Oliver said that he is constantly plagued by the thought of what his brother went through the night that he was murdered. He said that at night he has visions of his brother being murdered. He said, "I see Morgan waking up and trying to stop the dark figure on top of him. I see Morgan's strong arms trying to fend off what he can't see. I see Morgan covered in blood, trying to breathe. I see Morgan crying and screaming. Inside, he's so confused. He must have thought that he was dreaming." His parents, Dee and Alan, spoke of the pain of losing their son, not to an accident or an illness, but to a stranger who only did it for the thrill of it. Dee apologized for not being able to protect her son. She said, "How can I move on in time when my son remains in September the 8th, 2013, while the monster who took his life still breathes, eats and sleeps?
I regret that I have not been able to find words capable of adequately describing the level of their grief, anguish and suffering. But they should be assured that they have my most sincere sympathy." Mr. Kelsall, would you stand up, please? For the crime of murder, you are sentenced to imprisonment, comprising a non-parole period of 30 years.
Daniel would be sentenced to a minimum term of 30 years in prison and a maximum term of 40 years and 3 months. In handing down the sentence, Justice Hume said, "This is the most chilling case of murder, whether the offender killed for the thrill of it or as the result of a fantasy or obsession, I am unable to say. It was utterly senseless and needless. It must have been the doing of a very disturbed individual. He is not remorseful and he continues to deny his guilt." Daniel will be 51 years old when he is eligible for parole. That August, Daniel was sentenced to a further 6 months for possessing animated and cartoon child pornography. In the aftermath of the trial, New South Wales police revealed that after arresting Daniel, they had believed that he was a serial killer in the making, after uncovering that Daniel had stalked 2 other men in Neutral Bay, just 1 week after Morgan's murder. While it wasn't mentioned during trial, it was also revealed that around 6 months before Morgan's murder, he had told friends that an unknown man had followed him into his apartment. It was also revealed in the aftermath that in addition to confiding in his psychiatrists about his intrusive thoughts, he He had also told them that the medication they had placed him on did not feel right. He was later taken off the medication and prescribed fish oil and told to meditate. Following the sentence, Daniel's parents questioned why the psychiatrist took Daniel off medication when it was abundantly clear that something wasn't right. Whether or not he was mentally ill, he had dark and disturbing fantasies, which should have been taken seriously. While the murder of Morgan Huxley disturbed and captivated the upmarket community of North Shore, it had been foreshadowed by the killer himself. The deeply troubled teenager had long been having graphic thoughts running through his head, and he divulged these thoughts to two separate psychiatrists. Their inaction begs the question, if telling a psychiatrist that you had stolen a knife from work to murder somebody isn't enough to warrant further examination and for authorities to be informed, then what is? As Morgan's family tried to come to terms with what had happened to their much-loved son and brother, they were bombarded with lurid headline after lurid headline, placing the blame of Morgan's murder directly on his private and intimate life. The killer wasn't a scorned lover or a booty call gone wrong. He was a troubled man who had long been calling out for help. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, JN, Samantha, Sonia, Derek, Julia, Astrid, and Keith. In return for your support, you get Morbidology merch, including t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, fridge magnets. You also get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, as well as bonus content from some episodes, and ad-free and early release episodes. You can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month. There are absolutely no obligations, and you can cancel any time. You can also sign up annually to get 15% off. Also, I've been doing live streams up on the Stereo app. Last week, I did a true crime quiz, and there's going to be more true crime-related live streams. So please click the link to Stereo in my show notes so you don't miss them. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Weird Distractions. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Do you often find that you need a distraction from everyday life?
Do you like true crime, conspiracy theories, paranormal stories, and other weird, dark tales?
Well, tune in and turn up Weird Distractions Podcast, where we, your hosts, Christy
and Alex,
bring you a weird distraction to help you get through the work week.
Every Sunday morning, you can find our show on Apple Podcasts, Anchor, Spotify, Good Pods, and more.
So grab a snack, get comfy,
and make sure to lock those doors. Need a distraction? We got you.